welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This podcast is sponsored by Pearland EDC. Innovation lives here in Pearland, Texas. From pro-business resources and entrepreneur networks to an educated, diverse workforce, Pearland makes innovation happen. Connect with them at pearlandedc.com. Pearland, innovation lives here. My guest for today is Paul Cherukuri, Vice President for Innovation at Rice University. Paul is the first to hold his position at the brand new Office of Innovation at Rice. He joins the show today to talk a little bit about the reason Rice has zeroed in on advancing and promoting innovation, and why the university has a goal to collaboratively advance the city's future in the space. Paul, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I'm excited to have you and to really talk about a lot of things happening at Rice. But first, let's start with you and your career. Were you always interested in the world of academia? Tell me a little bit about how you got to where you got.
No, I think I was not interested in academia. I don't know how many people are born interested in academia. So I find that a little bit interesting. I think most of us who end up in the academic enterprise in the university end up there because we gravitated there, not because it was a primary target of their life. At least that's what I claim, because I certainly didn't. I think it's interesting to be in academia now, and so my background sort of lends itself to doing this sort of thing, simply because I've had a varied history. So just to kind of step back, just all the way back in the origin story of me, I was actually not born in the United States. I was born in India, and I came here as a little baby boy. It was actually 50 years ago. This, I just told you my age. 50 years ago to the day that I started my job here in innovation. So it was interesting that 50 years ago that we landed in America, I should say. So it was interesting that we started, I started here on that day. It was August 15th of 2022 when I started this job. And then that caused me to look back. So I can actually remember and have a pretty clear narrative. When we landed in America, my father came over as a surgeon and brought us over with him. Me, my brothers, and my mother came over and lived in New York City. And so a lot of Indian immigrants at the time were coming over because the United States had a policy of inviting more foreign-born doctors because there was a physician shortage and a nurse shortage. So I lived in Brooklyn for about 8 years, and then grew up. I think of it as growing up there. I still remember Brooklyn. So that's why I don't have a Southern accent, because I lived in the South for most of my life after that, because we moved to Texas for about a year or two. My father had a fellowship down in Houston. So that's when I first fell in love with Houston, because I was a little boy growing up here. My father worked at Texas Heart Institute. And so under Denton Cooley, who was a famous heart surgeon and artificial heart pioneer as well. And so that's when I first fell in love with Houston, because we would go over to Texas Heart and I would see all these animals that had these mechanical pumps inside their bodies. And so for me, Houston was cutting edge cool tech, always was from that moment, right? And so I always wanted to come back here. And what ended up happening was, after he did his fellowship, we moved to West Virginia, border of Kentucky and West Virginia, in the heart of the billion-dollar coal fields of Williamson, West Virginia, and Kentucky. And I pretty much grew up there, and went to the University of Kentucky and did physics. And it was an interesting time, because I did physics not knowing any physics or chemistry or anything, because I grew up in the hills. I didn't have much of an education. So I had to teach myself as much as I could in undergrad. That gave me this ability to sort of study a bunch of different things. And so that helped me out downstream. At the time, it was just a big struggle. But went through the University of Kentucky, and then had a meandering path where I was also going to medical school. I did medical school because my grades weren't good enough to get into the U.S. I went to the Caribbean, believe it or not. But I was always doing research. And I started doing research that got the interest of people back at Texas Heart again. And so they asked me to walk away from medical school and come up to help start up my first startup company called Mariner in Houston. And it was a glucose monitoring sort of system using optical sensors, because that was what my research was in undergrad at Kentucky and also in med school. And what ended up happening was I said no to them. I said, no, I want to finish medical school. Let me finish. And then I'll come back and I'll start my company. Right. But that the day that that happened was on 9/11. And I was in Washington, D.C. that at that moment when I was saying no to Houston and that I was going to hold off. But then after I said no, I walked out of the meeting and I said no. And then I see the planes hitting a plane hitting the Pentagon and other planes hitting the World Trade. And then they called me back 2 days later and said, we've got DOD funding that we really want to help the country, right? And help get into more aggressive measures to help the warfighter in healing in therapy. And so I said, okay, I'll take a year off of medical school. I'll come to Houston, start the company and get it on sure footing. And then I can come back later and hand it off. A year became 2 years. And I didn't go back because I ended up meeting Rick Smalley, who was a professor at Rice and who was a Nobel laureate in chemistry. He discovered the buckyball, right? And it was really the harbinger of all nanotechnology. So you can say that Rice really is the birthplace of a lot of nanotech. And so he comes up to me and he says, he was a very charismatic figure, which is rare in science. There's not a lot of us who can really kind of articulate or enamor people, but he was one of those. And he comes up to me and he says, hey, Paul, why don't you quit medical school and be a real doctor and come over to Rice? And so he wanted me to be his PhD student. So I was his last PhD student, his graduate student, one of his last. And so I'm very proud of that. And then my life took off after that, totally different course in my universe, and I went away for a while. It was an amazing time, but that's Houston, right? Houston gives you that opportunity.
Well, and I think it's very interesting that you have this varied background, because I think that's in a lot of ways makes you perfect for the role you have now, which is working with researchers, but also the outside of the off-campus translation of that technology and research. So tell me a little bit about the job, because you're the first person to hold the title of Vice President for Innovation at Rice, because it's a brand new department, the Office of Innovation, that is. So right. Tell me a little bit about like Rice's mission and impetus for founding the Office of Innovation.
This is really Reggie's vision, right? Reggie DeRoche, right, our new president, came in and he had hatched this idea actually a while back, and we did a national search for the vice president for innovation. And I was really surprised. I was actually on the committee for a while, lurking all over the country for this. And then the committee members came up to me and said, why the hell are you on this committee? Why don't you throw your name into it? And I said, I didn't feel like that was my gig. I was going to find who it was going to be and then, set them up and be happy, right? Or let them be happy. And then they asked me to do this. And I said, look, if you're serious that you really want me to go for this, okay, I'll fine to compete. But here's what I think we need to do. And it's going to be very, very jarring, right? It's a cultural shift that we're going to have to make. If we're really going to be an innovative university. And some of our peer institutions, our comparators, have been much more innovative, like MIT, right? They are set up this way. So how are we going to do this? Are we going to really make this happen? And because it's Reggie, we all adore Reggie in so many different ways. He's come in and he's just transformed this university. I said, okay, I'll throw my hat into the ring. And if you guys decide to select me, I'll do it. And here's what we're going to lay out. Are we going to go big or are we going to go home? Are we really do this thing? Because there's a lot of needs that need to happen or a lot of problems that need to be solved. And so how do we pull all that off? So that's what I put forward and ended up taking this role and now creating the vision for the office. But innovation is this distinct entity, different than research, right? So I think you probably have heard, let me step back a little bit more. The university, right? When we talked about academia at the beginning, right? That I'm in academia. It's an interesting thing because academia is not the word that actually covers well enough what happens inside of a university. There is so much that happens within a university that is not like a company. I actually, when I got my PhD here, I went away to Harvard for a little while, did a postdoc. Then I went into a faculty position at MD Anderson. And then I got married, settled down. And then I figured out my calling was to have a stable life with my family, right? Form a family. After I met my wife, Tanya, here at Rice, she's also a chemist. We went away to industry. And our eyes were wide open at that point. We could not believe, our minds were blown because the problems in industry weren't what we thought they were in academia, that they weren't the simplest problems. They were actually much more complicated. They may not be the most interesting fundamental breakthroughs of how the universe works, but they were equally complex in the sense of if you solve those problems, it will have incredible impact in people's lives. That's what changed for me, right? And so when I came back and they wanted me to do this innovation thing, the very first thing I said was, well, we need to be able to get our technology out the door first. One of the problems that universities have is we do all sorts of academic affairs, right, where we teach, and we also do research, but the output of research is really primarily papers, right? You publish a paper, and then you can hang your hat on that, which is wonderful. It gets knowledge out into the universe, which is a great thing to do. But then we hand it off and think there's somebody else out there to catch it. And the reality is companies are no longer catching those papers because R&D has really left a lot of corporate America. They wait for a startup to really develop these new ideas and develop them into technology that they can then acquire and then put out into a product line. That's what they wait for. It wasn't that way 40 years ago. Now they do some research, but their research is more D than R, right? It's more development than research. And so who's really making the breakthrough tech, right? And that's what Rice really does do, but we've had a bottleneck with getting the technology from the lab into the market. And so how do we unlock that? And that's the big thing that we're doing now is bringing that to bear, bringing all the forces to bear to do that. It's no longer a dirty thing at Rice to actually make companies. It's actually a valued and treasured thing. And we're going to promote the hell out of it is the idea.
I think that's so interesting because I've never had that transition, how that's evolved from, you know, research and R&D on campus, translating into papers, translating into corporates picking up, and now that being startups picking up, because I immediately see a major problem with that, and that startups taking really high research out of institutions where they have to do more work in development and commercialization, they need the funding to do that. And corporates just waiting around, waiting for the startups to come to fruition, not maybe helping a little bit with the financial aspect of that. But yeah, like that seems like a major problem that now that corporates are relying on startups to develop technology from off of campus. So that's maybe widened that valley of death that happens in the commercialization aspect.
It has. It totally has. And that's one of the issues, right? And part of it is how the economic pressures of a company have changed, right? Quarterly returns are the name of the game, and long-term sort of gains and making those investments haven't been a part of the corporate sort of financial structures. And so how do you break through that? The university has a unique role. We have an ability to not only we call it this unfettered pursuit of knowledge, which is what the university was set up to do. Not only do we do that, but the other part that's missing out of that whole idea of the federal government funding universities is that unfettered pursuit was for the greater good of society. That was a part of the entirety of the document. And we say that we can benefit society by making the papers, which is also true. But the timeline for that paper to actually have societal impact is 50 to 100 years if you're lucky. What's happening today? What are the breakthroughs you need today? How do you accelerate those, right? Because there's a lot of suffering in the world. And Rice is right in the middle of one of the greatest cities on planet Earth. And I, you know, I can argue that and win that argument very easily. So now some people will try to push back on that, but they don't know what they're talking about, because Houston is special on so many levels that it's ridiculous that nobody outside of Houston seems to realize this. But we're going to change that. Maybe these podcasts will help, right? But I think we have a moral responsibility as Rice to do more for this city and the country. And that's what Reggie really wanted us to do. And that's what innovation is really all about.
That's a really great mission. I think it's a uniquely Rice University mission, a uniquely Houston mission. So I think what might help is to talk a little bit more specifically about some of the things that you're doing that will really put into context this mission that you've outlined now. So one of those being, which I know a lot of people know about the ION, and a lot of maybe less people know the deep connection that it has with Rice University, which I've talked about a lot on the podcast and written a lot about on Innovation Map. So hopefully that lack of connection exposure is not there. But yeah, so tell me about how you specifically in the Office of Innovation bridges this gap between the off-campus ION and the on-campus activities that are happening within innovation.
Yeah. So the bridge is key. You know, one of the things we say at Rice is that we need to be beyond the hedges. We live within the hedges of Rice. How do we get beyond the hedges? One of the deliberate things that we're doing is creating a bridge to the ION. And then that bridge is this thing we call the Nexus. It's an organization that sits both within Rice, where we are going to be leasing space inside the ION, as this organization that reaches out to the community. And it shows that we're solving problems for the world. We'll solve problems and actually make solutions inside the ION in this Nexus facility. It will also provide a network where we will be learning about problems that are happening in the real world and bringing them into Rice. That is what the Nexus represents. It's both it's like a two-way street, right? Where we're going to solve problems out in the real world, get them to scale. And we'll be able to find new problems that are in the real world and bring them inside of Rice and create that new tech. We want to be able to make solutions. So that's what the Nexus represents. So stepping out of Rice, why do it? One of the interesting things about Rice is it's a lot like Wakanda in the Marvel movies. I don't know if you've watched Marvel movies, but it's this wonderful place where we've got so much technology in our labs that we never shared with the world. Right. And if you think of it that way, you go, it's a crying shame. Why? Part of it is just the way the system is set up. It's not that people don't want to do it. It's that we just haven't had the means to do it. So that's what the innovation ecosystem that we're building is going to do. We're going to demonstrate that inside the ION. And I really also see the ION district having a capability for the entirety of the city. We want other universities there. University of Houston is a fantastic university, sitting right here in Houston, right? And you have Rice, and you have A&M, which is really, eventually, A&M is going to be a part of Houston, because I think Houston's going to take over College Station the way we're expanding. You can see all these sort of interconnects happening. And so the ION represents this catalyst, but it's an aggregator. It's a concentrator of excellence for around the city. And I think around the country, you're seeing more and more moving into the Innovation District, into the Midtown Innovation District. Greentown Labs is there, right? This is the largest clean tech accelerator program. And you've got that right there next to the ION building. So we're really designing this place so that we can connect to the world better. And if anything, that's what the ION represents. And that's what we're creating programs around it. For example, let me give you one other specific thing. We have this program called TEX-E, which is Texas Energy Entrepreneurship Program. It's a program where we've taken the top universities in the Texas Triangle, A&M, UT, Prairie View A&M, U of H, Rice, partnering to create an entrepreneurship program for energy so that we can get our students to work together between the institutions. This has been founded by a wonderful man named David Baldwin, who's really started this beautiful collaboration between our universities to be able to do this, to drive this forward. And we're going to put that in Greentown Labs and in the Ion District. And we've already got a group of students who are working on a lot of energy transition technology. That's just one thing that we can do together that people on the coast don't really do yet. They may learn it from us, but we're going to be doing it first. And I think that's the nice, you know, sort of cultural aspect of Houston. We kind of get it together when we need to. And that's what you're seeing.
Yeah. Well, I think, and going back to comparing Rice as it has just, you know, created this innovation office, comparing to other universities that have had a more longstanding, I guess, foothold in the technology transfer, but also in innovation, at least Houston maybe being late to develop, or Rice being late to develop, this has the opportunity of perspective and learning from other organizations that have done it and collaboration. Because I think that ultimately, when you kind of boil down some of the problems with technology transfer from universities to commercialization, yeah, it's breaking down some walls and having more communications and opportunities.
It is. It's a big part of it. You know, it's the tech transfer issue. Tech transfer is an interesting term because, okay, so here's the thing. I'm just going to say this. I say this a lot, and so I shouldn't be shy about it. But technology transfer is an interesting term in the university because the technology that's being transferred doesn't exist in the tech transfer office. It actually exists in the labs and the minds of the people who are doing it. But then we put up barriers for them to transfer their knowledge into the world. What we really say by tech transfer is we are talking about creating monopolies around the technology that we're inventing. Patenting, right? Patenting is a monopoly. It isn't a transfer, right? The idea of creating a monopoly is to maximize your ability to transfer into a market and dominate the market. But that doesn't necessarily mean tech transfer. There are many ways to transfer technology. Patenting is one, but there are many other avenues to getting your technology out the door. For example, Rice 360 here at Rice, right? Hence the name. Rice 360 develops technology to help newborn children in Malawi and in under-resourced countries. They're not making money off of this, and there aren't patents to be had, but they're creating technology and really having impact and saving. I can't tell you how many countless babies and mothers they've saved in Africa. Does that mean that because they did not go through the tech transfer office that they didn't really, you know, transfer their technology? No, it's actually they're transferring in a different pathway. There's many ways to get impact out into the world. And I think tech transfer itself is really an operation to not maximize impact as much as maximize revenue for most universities. We, of course, do care about the revenue and the licensing stream and the business side of this, right? But the maximal target for us is impact. Is there a way you can do that through a monopoly play, through patenting? Yes. Are there alternative ways for us to get our technology out the door faster through trade secrets and still be able to commercialize? Yes, you can do that. All of these things are things that we don't actually teach appropriately inside of most universities. And we're creating that infrastructure now to be able to do that.
Yeah, I guess not having a day-to-day or at all place in the world of the university tech transfer, I was just using it more of like a broad term. But it makes sense that that's historically been what the top priority for universities is, that patenting opportunity for that revenue and just being the usual way of getting technology out of universities and into the commercial world. But there are a lot of opportunities and it's good that there's someone like you kind of challenging the status quo, right? To open more doors for that, right?
We are challenging, I think, in some ways. If anything, the challenge is really recognizing that the status quo is changing. That's a little bit of part of this, right? If this had been a few years ago, I don't know if the universities would have been ready for it. What really catalyzed this was the pandemic in so many ways, right? Because we were woefully unprepared to be able to respond to the pandemic at technological scales, right? That we could not, we had new ideas inside the lab, we couldn't get them out there. We just didn't have the knowledge to be able to scale. Some of our units did, Rice 360 did. Oshman Engineering Design Kitchen did. They made the bag valve mask, you know, those bags, and being able to compress properly because we had ventilator problems, right? They couldn't make these things fast enough. So if you made these bag valve mask system, you should be able to help hospitals and patients live longer, right? Because during the pandemic, a lot of people were dying because you couldn't get a ventilator, right? This was a bridge. So could you do that? Could you produce those? And we were ready to produce very quickly through some of the units, but we couldn't do that with so much stuff that was hidden in our labs, right? And so that was part of the awakening of why Rice has risen out of the sort of ashes that we've been in. We're coming up and out after the pandemic, and innovation represents that response. You also see the federal government changing. This is also an interesting little story. The federal government, NSF, National Science Foundation, has traditionally done discovery research, right? It's like, why does the universe work? You know, what are the fundamentals of making the universe tick? This sort of thing. Now they are looking at a little bit more on the development side. And that's why you see so much money pouring in into the universities in the next few years, because there's so many calls out there for new money. Whether it's chips, you know, making new semiconducting kind of, you know, materials and technologies, or it's healthcare, or you know, ARPA-H is a new entity, right? All of these things are happening. Much of this is because the pandemic shook the United States and said, we can no longer live in a world where we're not making things and we're not taking breakthroughs out of the universities and putting them into the real world. The Innovation Office was created to be responsive to all of this new change. It is not an overstatement to say that there has never been a time like this in the history of academics, industry, and the universe, really, in society, to have such an opportunity to make discoveries and have impact. This is a very different moment.
I think just to build off of that, one of my favorite questions to ask people is, and I think, you know, now that you've set that scene of this unprecedented time, which overused phrase, but clearly works in this situation, or this intersection of universities and business, what keeps you up at night as you think of the future of Rice's innovation coming out of campus? Because you've kind of set the scene of this external influences that are changing things. So what are you know, pandemic is behind us for the most part. Obviously, we're still reacting to some things that have happened over the past few years, but are you worried things will revert back, or are you keeping an eye of other external impacts that could change what's happening?
That is a great question. And I know you probably ask that a lot, but
I ask it in general a lot, but I gave you some time to think about it by like really taking a winding route to asking it.
I saw that. I was appreciating that you were doing that. So like when I get home, there are things that I talk about ad nauseum with my family and also my team, right? Here in the tight sort of corners of trust inside the university. But here's the thing. Whatever is going to happen in the next 5 years, nobody can really predict specifics, but there are generalities that I think we can predict, which is there is going to be some other sort of event, some event in the United States or globally that's going to affect our economy, certainly, but likely directly our lives in some meaningful way. How are we going to respond to that is the big thing. How is the university getting ahead of the next wave of issue on the planet, whether it's climate or bio or some sort of calamity, right? Some weather catastrophe, right? These are the sorts of things. I don't think that we are ready yet with being able to make new technology in the United States at scale, not quickly. manufacturing has left our shores in so many ways, right? So that worries me. So it's every week I am having conversations about how do we finance and build infrastructure to be able to take our technology out of the lab and into the market? And how do we de-risk that quickly? And by quickly, I mean within the next year, not 5 years. How do we move? We cannot waste time with being trying to figure out how we're going to do X, Y, and Z and whether or not we should. There is an urgency here because we know that in 5 years from now, there's going to be something that we're not going to be ready for. And there are key areas that we should be ready for that we as Rice and we as Houston are uniquely positioned to do. Like this morning, we were meeting with government leaders, and we were talking about the fact of Houston, right? Number one port, biggest medical center in the world, energy capital of the world. Rice is the top university in Texas, and it's in the largest city in Texas. We have an economy that can dwarf anybody else. Then you expand Houston into the Texas Triangle and you put all those cities into it. We can do more in that area, in the Texas Triangle, than I think any region in the United States. It is on us to make the difference. And we're not yet because we haven't really galvanized the forces towards the greater good, key areas of making these investments, right? We're kind of playing this game, the traditional game. Slowly but surely, we're getting there. Having conversations with Houston and Houston leaders and Texas leaders, I think, is getting there. But I think the thing that's really going to unlock that are individuals who are coming to Rice who want to create a new world. And that is what the ION represents, and that's what Rice represents, is, if anything. It is this attractor of incredible talent. I mean, the brains in this university are just stunning. And, you know, I'm not smart enough to go here. I am smart enough to work here. That's the big difference. But that's the sort of imbalance. So if you enable the students and the faculty to do what they're doing, get the hell out of the way and let them go, provide the infrastructure. That's what we got to do. And we see TMC doing the same thing, right? We see the ION district coming up. And I think there are pockets all over Houston of innovation that's happening. And innovation, by the way, is in my world, is defined as invention times commercialization. That's my equation for innovation. And it's not just my equation. I've stolen that from others. But invention times commercialization, you can have no inventions, and you will have zero innovation. If you have no commercialization, you'll have zero innovation. You need to couple the two. You need to take your new tech, commercialize it so that it can hit the world. That is when innovation really starts to take root. So we've got to do that, and we've got to do that as collaboratively as possible, which is going to be the challenge. It's still a challenge in Houston, but we're getting there.
I think this line of thinking is very interesting to me because when we talk about Houston, we tend to, you know, talk about the history of Houston and what we've been able to accomplish and really great things, but the man on the moon, artificial heart transplants, like really great things. Also, Houston's great. We love to talk about how great the diversity is, cost of living, everything is great. But what you're talking about is like, yes, we're great, but like, we still have a lot to do. And there's a lot of potential, but that's still just what it is right now. And it's kind of like a call to action for everyone to play their part.
Well, I will also say, you know, that I think 5 years ago, it was more potential than kinetic energy. Sorry, I went all physics-y, but meaning that you're moving more now than we did in the years past. I see a lot more movement and activity. And what's really great is the energy in the room when people get together in Houston. It's really rather stunning. I've seen it in Austin. I've seen, San Francisco, Boston. I go all over, right? And I'm not totally knocking the other areas, but I kind of am because there is a sort of natural sense of growing here that isn't being forced. It is just happening. And, you know, we always say it's organic and all that, but there is something special happening in Houston. And someday, you know, a few years from now, we can talk again, and I will tell you who has noticed that I can't talk about publicly. There are people who are showing up at Rice for the first time and in Houston for the first time that would shock people to know that they have noticed that there's a pattern emerging. So it's happening. It's a real thing. And we just can't lose that spirit, because we've got a moment here that we've got to ride forward.
Well, we've talked about a lot of different things, but one thing I wanted to zero in on, because just outside looking in, I've noticed a lot of momentum behind energy transition coming out of Rice. I mean, a lot of people have some momentum toward making Houston an energy transition capital, not just the energy capital of the world. So Rice is doing a couple things, both at the Ion and on campus. So wanted to see, you know, how you think about really affecting change, because going back to everything you just mentioned of this opportunity and this potential to really change the world, very important goal, especially when it comes to energy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really happening in this sense that we're getting together to really solve that problem in a sort of coherent way. The real challenge on the energy transition side is this dual challenge that Bobby Tudor, who I think is the patron saint of energy transition, he has been saying this over and over again, of the dual challenge, meaning that we have to provide more energy for a growing world, and we also have to somehow reduce CO2 production. How do you do that with the current energy sources that we have? And the reality is we don't have great solutions yet. And by great solutions, I mean scalable technology that can be cost effective and can be deployed widely and that can be utilized. One of the interesting sort of questions that we get is, well, we can switch software on and off pretty easily. Why is it we can't do hardware? And a big part of it is just physical infrastructure is hard to change. We have for over 100 years, for example, here's an interesting conversation I had the other day about the grid, right? You remember the grid issues that we had famously a few years ago, where, you know, because our lines are all above ground, we had a deep freeze and it broke the system in some way. And it was really, you know, there's many, many sort of nuances to that. But then, you know, in an innovation sense, why is it that we can't just upgrade the grid? This is the question, right? Well, it's a lot of money to do that. Well, instead of upgrading the grid, why don't we just forget the grid? Is there a way to get over the grid? Those are the kinds of things that can only be answered inside of crazy people's minds inside of a university. That's not something you think about in a company, an established company that's actually making, you know, is making its profit off of energy distribution. They're not thinking of that. They're thinking about, how do I upgrade my system and dominate their market and using the skill sets they have. Inside the university, you can come up with a startup that can actually design new technology from the labs that does grid with, you know, in a virtual sense, a wireless network. These are very, very difficult problems, right? And that's research and science technology that have to be scaled up. Does the physics support it? Yeah, the physics supports it. The efficiency of doing something like wireless electricity is not something that is easy to do, but it is something that can be done, which means you have to develop the crazy breakthrough tech, right? And the government's not going to fund that initially. You've got to take really crazy shots that are based in physics, first principles, that you can drive forward. That's the kind of stuff that we're into. Now, we're making all sorts of new fuels that you've never heard of, that you wouldn't think, that you would think that we had already solved some problems in the fuel space. There's stuff that we've never made that's way cleaner, but it's way harder to make. And how do you do that, right? That's where Rice comes in. That's where U of H and all of our partners come in. We can come up with crazy stuff that is based in reality and then can be scaled. And that's uniquely something I think we can do in the Triangle. Certainly Houston has got to lead that. I think Houston is going to be exactly where it's got to happen. If it doesn't happen here, energy transition ain't happening. It's my view.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a, like I said, a lot of people are, Bobby Tudor and a lot of other organizations within Houston are really all aboard that train. Right. So Now we just gotta make sure the train keeps going and goes to the right place.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of cars on that train. I'm just extending this way too far on the train analogy, but you get what I mean. There's so many institutes at Rice. The Ken Kennedy Institute is fantastic, right? Led by Angela Wilkins and Lydia Kavrocki. Brilliant AI, energy applications, all sorts of things, right? And then, great people. And then on top of that, you've got synthetic biology. We have more synthetic biology experts in the country than any other university is Rice, right? SynBio is taking off. Solugen, right, is located in Houston. Again, these are the kinds of things that we are doing uniquely. It really is not happening on each of the coasts. So as soon as they get wind of this, they being the East and West Coast, they're going to try to steal our people and try to move the companies over. We've got to fight against that because I think there is a uniqueness here, a unique capability that we can capitalize on, certainly. But we have a culture here and an economy here is going to really drive it forward. So anybody who's thinking about trying to move away, don't do it. Think long game. Stay in Houston. You're going to win if you do. So that's my bottom line message for that.
Well, you mentioned Solugen, and the founder actually recently gave a talk, and he said just that Solugen had the opportunity to move to the West Coast, and he said no and denied funding in that way. And I think his theory is that every company has a city company fit, and these types of companies are going to find that fit in Houston. They're going to find maybe some funding on the coast, but you got to think of that long game. So that's a great reminder.
This is Gaurab. Is that who? Yeah. So, yeah. He and I have strangely similar philosophies. It's a brother from another mother, I think, in many ways. It's fascinating. And you can't write those kinds of stories. Like I said, there's something strange happening in the sense that our culture is fostering it, right? And people who live here get this sense that, no, I'm staying here because there's something else going on. And this is the place to be. And it's not San Francisco and Silicon Valley. Now, there's a lot of capital out in those areas, right? And I would say they're more coordinated capital networks than we are. We have a lot of capital in Houston, but I don't think we've really unlocked the puzzle yet. And that's also part of the sort of crystallization that we're doing inside of Rice. We're really going to try to bring that to bear, to have venture in a way that makes sense for Houston.
Well, I think it's all very fascinating. And you and I could probably talk about this for another several minutes, if not more. But thank you for joining the show. And for giving me and all of my listeners a lot to think about on the future of Houston and Rice's role it's going to play and this kind of greater innovation ecosystem.
Yeah, no, thank you. This is awesome. I love what you're doing. I think this is a great, an inspiring thing you're doing. So thank you for the invitation. Would love to do this again anytime.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to check in because things are happening. So we gotta check back in sometime. So thank you again.
A year from now, you're going to see some really crazy cool stuff.
Well, I can't wait.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.